Why was it, Marcy wondered, that the girls had to play on the girls' side and the boys on the boys' side? The boys had swings and a slide and monkey bars and a basketball hoop, but the girls had only swings and a slide and monkey bars. Why couldn't all the children play on all the schoolyard? What would happen if she just went and got the basketball out of the box in the coat hall before anyone else got it and went on to the boys' side and tried to make a basket? What would happen?
The author of that segregated incident was Jacqueline Jackson, but it could be you. The Author Is You, a Wisconsin School of the Air series about the process of writing creatively. To conduct today's program, She's Got Eyes of Blue, here's children's author Jacqueline Jackson.
We're calling our program today Eyes of Blue, and what does that have to do with the item about playing on the girls' side or on the boys' side? The Eyes of Blue comes from a little song that my mother taught us when we were kids or was singing around. I think it was a popular song before I was even born. And it went something like, "She's got eyes of blue. I never cared for eyes of blue, but she's got eyes of blue. That's my weakness now." And it's just a sort of a simple little corny love song. And as kids, we parodied it. We'd sing, "She's got a cauliflower ear. I never cared for a cauliflower ear." And going on to the other sorts of things. Recently, I was in a church group where a man said, "How could I be prejudiced? I grew up in a town where there weren't any black people. How could I be prejudiced?" Well, I was prejudiced enough to have prejudice against him for thinking that he wasn't prejudiced, because he was, in my opinion, one of the most prejudiced men that I had ever met. I also recently heard about an experiment that a teacher conducted with a group of kids who lived in such a town where there weren't any people other than their own sort. And she was thinking that you can very well be prejudiced by growing up with just others of your own sort. And she was thinking toward when these kids would move to other places. This has been in articles. My children have seen it on TV, and I've never run into it yet. I've just heard about it, and so perhaps some of you that are listening know more about this experiment than I do. But she told her class, as I understand it, that they were going to play a game. And she divided the kids into the blue-eyed kids and the brown-eyed kids. And she said, "Now today," and I can't tell you which day was first, "we're going to favor all the blue-eyed students, and all the brown-eyed students are going to have to wear white paper collars, and they're going to have to sit in the back of the room, and all the nice things will happen to the blue eyes." The day began, and whenever a blue-eyed child would recite well, he would get praised, and when a brown-eyed child recited, whether he recited well or not, he received only indifference, and the blue eyes got to go out to recess first, and all the good things happened to the blue-eyed kids, and the brown-eyed kids got more and more bewildered and unhappy, and the blue eyes were having a great time, thoroughly enjoying all this attention and all this favor. Well, then, the second day, the teacher reversed it. The blue-eyed kids had to put on the white paper collars and sit in the back of the room, and all the nice things happened to the brown-eyed students. And the day went on, but not as before, because instead of the blue-eyed students being sort of bewildered and passive, they had known the enjoyment of being the favored ones the day before. And so they began to do horrid, nasty things to the brown-eyed students. And the brown-eyed students were still chafing and rankling under the injustices of the day before. And so instead of merely enjoying themselves and a bit of crowing over the blue-eyeds that were now getting the same treatment that they had the day before, they began taking it out in more physical ways, pinching, mean things. Now, I'm not sure all my facts are straight on this, and I may have added a few details that weren't there out of my own imagination. But at the end of those 2 days, I understand that the students then discussed their feelings. And it gave them, I think, some insight into how it feels both to be the favored group in a prejudiced situation and to be the underdog group in a situation. I first heard about this experiment when my daughter Jill came home from school and said that her teacher had heard about it and suggested that they try it as a class and see what the results would be with their class. The class discussed it, and they decided that they were too scared to try this experiment. They would prefer not to try this experiment. And so they didn't, but two boys volunteered and said they would like to be the ones to be the victims of prejudice. And so the class was instructed to either pay no attention to Chris and the other boy, or if they did, to treat them in unfair sort of ways and so forth. And I talked to Chris after it was over, and he said, "I could hardly stand it. I could hardly stand it." That I got angrier and angrier, and even though I knew that I had volunteered for it and that it was just a game, that my feelings weren't just a game. My feelings were very real. This was a sixth grade boy. I'd be interested if any of our classrooms listening have tried this experiment or if they would want to try this and would have some access to the way this other teacher did it in finding out what sort of feelings you get in a mock situation where you know that blue eyes are not superior to brown eyes, and yet you are being treated as if they were, or as if, in the case of brown eyes, that they weren't. Most of us, I would guess, listening, belong to the dominant culture, and so, as a whole, we probably haven't experienced prejudice as a group. But in thinking about prejudice, I've realized that we have all experienced it as individuals, or I'd guess practically all of us. My husband was a skinny, knobby-kneed little boy, as I was a little girl. But being a skinny, knobby-kneed little boy is harder, because a boy is supposed to be an athlete and is supposed to be strong, and he had the experience of being the last one chosen when lining up for athletic games and things of this sort. And he hated those sorts of competitive sports where being small was a handicap. And our position in our family or in the groups that we go around with, the youngest, much as our kids love their little sister who has a 6-year gap between the next one, she's 5 and Jill is 12 at the moment, much as they love her, she gets an awful lot of, "Oh, don't be such a pest," or, "No, you can't come because you're not old enough." And those of us that had a younger position in the family are used to being tag-alongs, not being able to do what the older kids do. And then there's the very real problems in age. We change age. But what about, say, the girl who grows too tall for our accepted standards of our culture, or the boy that never gets over 5 feet. All his life he is plagued with being shorty and having the kind of treatment that the more nearly average size dishes out to the short sort of person. There's a book by Susan Heller that I saw a while back and haven't been able to locate since, and I think it's called Fat Girl. And it's a very sort of simple picture book of this girl that was very fat and how her mother had to take her to special stores or else make her clothes, and how the other kids teased her and called her fatty, and she was the object of ridicule. And finally, the girl decided that she would do something about it. And she started to diet and so forth. And I thought to myself, oh, yes, this is going to be one of those stories where here is a problem and then everything gets all right again. And I believed this up until the last page, when the girl got slimmer and slimmer, and pretty soon they no longer called her fatty, and she could buy her clothes at the store just like anybody else. And the kids quit teasing her. And then I turned to the last page, and it said, now they're teasing a girl that is too tall. And this brought the point home that some of these handicaps, if you want to call them that, and I think they really are, you can change, you can outgrow, but certain things, such as being tall, you have to learn to live with. You have to learn that there are going to be people who will hold this against you, even though it's nothing than you can that you can do anything about yourself. But you know, here are individual prejudices towards our look, towards our size, towards our ability. But there's another way, I think, that we're all becoming very conscious of right now, that we are discriminated against as groups, and that is in being boys or being girls. The women's lib movement has brought this very strongly to the fore. And it's not just being a girl, although that's what you're hearing about. Let's take a look at boys. It's long been my feeling that boys are discriminated against in the ordinary elementary school setting. Studies have shown us that boys develop and mature more slowly. And so when they are in classes with girls of the same age, the girls are usually quicker and ahead. And so the boys, on the whole, get the attitude that they are not as bright, that they are not as quick, that the girls are superior. And our whole school setting usually encourages this sort of thing, the girl-like behavior. The girls are more able to sit at the desks. They follow directions better. They please the school teacher better. And so girlish, or what is considered girlish behavior, is favored. And the running around, the jostling, the noise, the little boy behavior is frowned on because it's easier for the teacher, it's easier for the school situation to have the little girl kind of behavior, so that boys are discriminated against. And then the whole attitude that there are certain things that boys should be, that it is not manly to cry, for instance, that tender thoughts, that sensitive feelings, that the arts, poetry, music, things of that sort are for girls, but that boys should be out there doing more aggressive sort of activities. For instance, I've known fathers that have gotten very upset when their little boys are even playing in the doll corner in nursery school. This is what girls should be doing. The boys should be out playing with trucks and hammers and things of that sort. And I've noticed in the comics, I don't know if it's still that way, but it used to be that the symbol for a sissy in the comic strips was a boy walking along, usually in short pants, with his hair cut in a sort of girlish style, with glasses on, and carrying a violin case. Now, why is it that it's okay for girls in our culture to play the violin, and it isn't okay for the boys to play the violin? And if you want to be a poet, you have to go against the grain of our American society to be a poet. There's lots of books that you could read that talk about prejudice of all sorts. Your teachers probably know them, and I've mentioned some in the manual. More, I think, on racial prejudice than on prejudice towards girls, prejudice towards boys. Quite a few, I think, you could find on individual prejudices. But when we come to writing about these things, we don't really need the books, because I do think we've all had these sorts of experiences. I would love to see your stories about your experiences with discrimination. Not just when you've been the victim, but also maybe when you've been the one that's been hurting the other person. Perhaps when you've discovered that you've been hurting somebody without even realizing that you've been doing it, that you've been blinded to what they really are because of something that is more obvious, their looks, their handicaps. I'd like to know your stories about your experience of being a girl or of being a boy, where you felt that it's been a real advantage, where you felt that it's been a distinct disadvantage. There are other ways, too. You may feel, as our eldest daughter expressed to me once, I'm not like other people. They can't understand me. I feel different. And I think that this is true with all of us. We are all individuals. We all have areas where we're not understood, where we feel different, where we're not accepted. A lot of us hide those feelings and pretend we don't have them, or pretend we feel something that we don't feel in order to go along with the gang or be a part of the group. You might think about, do I treat other people meanly because I've been treated meanly? Some boys out on the schoolyard next to our house, some high school boys, were smashing bottles on the grade school schoolyard. And I went over and said, you know, pick up those bottles. I said, I've got a kid that's on this schoolyard, and I don't want her falling down and cutting herself on those bottles. And so I stood over those guys and made them pick up all these bottles they smashed. And one of the things they said was, well, nobody ever picked up bottles for us. We cut ourselves on bottles. And so you see, here they are, just repeating the chain. But if we think about it, we can beat the chain. We can break the chain. Because we're able to reflect, we're able to see how prejudice and discrimination separates people rather than bringing them together, and to look at our own experiences and discover how we feel when we're separated and how we feel when we're not separated. So that it really comes back to that little ditty about eyes of blue. When you really get to know another person, when you have some understanding for how they feel, and have felt these things yourself, it doesn't matter that that person has eyes of blue or a cauliflower ear or a freckled nose or a hump on her back. What really matters is that all of us have these same feelings in our hearts.
This has been a program in the creative writing series, The Author Is You, conducted today by children's author Jacqueline Jackson. This is Ken Ost for the Wisconsin School of the Air.